Hello, hello,
and welcome to Built on Hope, a podcast dedicated to competitive Imperial Assault. I am your host, Isaac, and in this episode, with us today, we have two marvellous, marvellous human beings who are actually also from the ISCP Steering Committee. We will introduce them in due time, but before we get onto them, we are, as usual, joined by our other two hosts. First and foremost, David, how are you doing?
I am doing wonderful and super excited for another episode about the meta. We had not planned on having so many meta episodes, but they've really sparked a lot of discussion in the IACP Slack and Facebook groups, and somehow we ended up with three, and I think it'll be really good.
Exactly. And we are also joined, as usual, by the marvelous Jess. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. And I've got some news for you. So next weekend, that's the 27th of June, Saturday, there's going to be the Porg Cup event. So it's going to be the first Vassal seasonal tournament. Coverage of this Porg Cup event will be done by myself, and I'm going to be joined by Alistair Scott to do some streaming and providing some commentary on TV Boy's YouTube channel, IA Command. So if you are interested in taking a look at some of the games, but you're not playing in it yourself, then come join us on the stream. And it is going to be starting at 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And it's going to have the Swiss rounds being played on the Saturday with the top cut scheduled with the players throughout the next few weeks themselves. There is an entry fee of $15, and that's to fund the prizes. So the prizes have just been announced. There's going to be a participation prize of a General Vice alt art card, a top four prize of an Imperial themed unit mat, and the winner is going to get a very prestigious medal. Another event that's going to be starting up next week as well, or rather the Monday after, is going to be the Jedi Trials League for beginner players. So if you have any friends or family members that you want to try to get into skirmish, this is a perfect opportunity for that. So it's going to start on Monday, the 29th of June, and it's going to be one game played a week online and played with other beginners of the same kind of skill level. And the players will also have access to experienced players to chat with and help to advise them, setting up how to play online. So great place for any beginners out there to start. There is now a worldwide leaderboard for players for IACP to track player records. So the Squad Commander Series 2020 has just started up. And so any of players that are attending a qualifying event, such as the Porg Cup, are going to be automatically added to this worldwide leaderboard. And if you don't want to have your record tracked, just let the event organizer know so that they won't put you on. But that's going to be a pretty cool feature for the new seasons for ISCP. There also has been an update to the Tabletop Simulator mod, courtesy of Trevize. Links to everything that I've just discussed will be in the show notes, where to sign up for the Porg Cup or the Jedi Trials League. All of that can be found on the IA Continuity Project website, and I'm also giving you the link to the Tabletop Simulator mod. Alright, so then I'd like to introduce our first guest. We have Jake on. Jake, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So the Imperial Assault Continuity Project, I was a founding member of, so I worked with Kenny and Chris, and then we also added in Brett and DT, the champions, later. I was the one who's been pushing for it for a while before that, because I'd seen what happened with Heroescape, where they kept the game going for, I think it's still going, more than a decade after it was discontinued, because people in the community just got together and started making their own units. So I was inspired by that and wanted to get that into our community as well. So I've been on there since the beginning. Also, I'm on the Twin Troopers podcast, but that's been on extended hiatus. That is probably going to continue indefinitely, because I've been very busy with my studies in law school, and Eric recently had a kid, just off for a while, but I'm definitely still wanting to be in the podcast game. So here I am.
Crossover! Woo!
Marvelous. We are also joined by another marvelous member of the community. This is none other than Noah, also known as TV Boy. He runs the IA Command YouTube channel, who has been kind enough to let myself, Jess, and David stream commentary on the IACP Vassal events on his YouTube channel.
More crossover!
Hey! Exactly. We are bringing all of the mass media together in this episode. So, Noah, hello, welcome to the podcast, and how are you doing?
Hello, thank you for having me on. It's great to be on. And before I say anything else, I just wanted to say thank you to our three hosts here, especially David and Jess, but you as well, Isaac. Thank you so much for all the help you have brought to the channel, to the YouTube channel. The streaming, the live streaming of the events would not be possible without you three, and especially without David and Jess running the stream and providing the commentary. So thank you for providing that to the community, and I'm glad that the YouTube channel exists to help facilitate that.
You're very welcome. We've had a lot of fun.
Our pleasure.
So Noah, do you want to talk about why you started the YouTube channel for one, and you know, how you got into the game and why you've been playing?
Kind of a long story, but I'll just do the quick and short of it. You know, we were just playing games at the local store and playing campaign and skirmish, and I thought, I have a camera on my phone. There's no YouTube content out there. There's no like recorded games being regularly put up the way there is for a ton of other different collectible games and tabletop games. So I bought a tripod, I stuck my phone on it, I started recording, and I put it on YouTube. And it kind of just went from there, and I've learned a lot and gotten better from it and gotten more efficient. So now I'm not spending like 10 hours of video editing, but I wanted to do it because I wanted also to get more exposure on the game. I feel like when you can go and watch people play, it gets people more engaged and wanting to play more themselves. And I think that's definitely happening now, thanks to Jess and David and you, Isaac, for the fact that we have coverage and recorded games that people can go watch is, I think, helping a lot with increasing engagement with IACP from people who otherwise wouldn't be playing or can't play as often. I think it really motivates people when they see the cards in action to want to go and play it with themselves. So I want to talk about my committee experience. I was kind of skeptical when IACP came out, especially since we were, you know, it wasn't a sure thing, the future of the game yet. But I recently saw, there was an article, I think, on either Forbes or Kotaku about the Star Wars card game, like the original one, not from FFG, and how their community actually picked up that game when it was discontinued and got the blessings from George Lucas.
Whoa!
So they were able to pick that up and keep using like new assets and new art to make new cards, which, you know, sadly we don't have because Lucas doesn't have control of Lucasfilm anymore. There was an article about how successful they have been and how their like world championships attract like 500 players or something crazy like that. Anyway, I read that and thought, wow, you know, like this can work, especially after what happened with FFG discontinuing everything. So I got a lot more interested in IACP after that. And Chris approached me, I think, back in February. And I was just like, yeah, I've just been waiting for you to contact me. Yeah, really having a great time on the steering committee, just being able to bring ideas. I know you guys have probably seen a lot of my custom stuff that I put out. Like I was making custom cards before this. When you have a bunch of people that can then yell at you for the crazy stuff you're putting on cards and then actually make it into like a real functioning card, it's a pretty amazing experience.
It really is. And I definitely have to say from a personal level as well that you coming onto the committee has been a huge, huge help. Your designer diaries are absolutely splendid.
My background is in communications, so I feel like the specialty I bring to the project is my content creation and communications, and also just my understanding of like transparency and showing people behind the scenes helps a lot with engagement and making sure you guys kind of know what we're doing. I mean, you as an audience, the community, it's a lot more helpful than just a black wall or a black box that has cards coming out of it.
Completely agree.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another Knowledge and Defense episode. And we are going to be talking about the meta again. This will be part 3. We previously talked about the two definitions of meta in terms of how you play the game about the game and how you play to your region, as well as the acronym meta, which is the most effective tactics available. And we also went through how the FFG version of Imperial Assault's meta has developed and what are some of the, you know, themes and interesting lists that you can look forward to if you attend an event. This episode, though, will be all about IACP, and it will focus more specifically on the acronym definition of meta, which really leads into how we can figure out what tactics or what mechanics are most effective within Imperial Assault, and how IACP can make good decisions about card design, design of new models, design of new command cards, and how they'll use these tools to tune the game and make sure we have a really fresh playing field. So I think everybody knows what Jessica, Isaac, and I think about these ideas. But we'll go first to Noah, who hasn't been on the podcast before talking about meta. Noah, let me know what your thoughts are.
Thank you. I have a background in like competitive card games, you know, Magic the Gathering. And then before that, when I was younger, I played like Yu-Gi-Oh and Pokemon cards competitively. So for me, my understanding of the meta is more around like what's actually being played and what kind of is being used in the real world to win actual tournaments and actual competitions. But you guys kind of covered that. So for me, the meta as an acronym is kind of a newer take on the concept. And I was thinking about it a lot before in the past week and how you can kind of divide them in a like epistemological way of like what how they are. Whereas if meta, like my understanding of meta being like what people are actually playing, meta as an acronym is more about like what is objectively good regardless of what's actually being used. And then for me, the meta as an acronym kind of it's almost presumptuous because it requires like a level of omniscience about the game that most normal players don't have. I've been reading a lot lately about like AI in games. It's been kind of a fascination for me. And so there's like recently they made an AI that was able to play StarCraft and actually played the game for 900 simulated years in the computers for like a month. That's the only way you can really like say that you know with perfect information what the best tactics available are. So I like to think of it more of as a different acronym, which is MECTA. And I'm trying to coin this now, just like I coined Rebel Landing Gear. Rebel Landing Gear was a success, so this is going to be a success too. So anyway, most effective known tactics available is how I like to approach this. So hence the K in the middle of it. Also, I liked having two different things for two different concepts. So meta versus mecta. But anyway.
Also, mecta just sounds a lot cooler.
It's like Godzilla yes. versus Mecha Godzilla. Yeah. So if we think of it more like that, then it becomes like, what are the best tactics we know about? And regardless of who's playing what do those tactics look like? And that helps us for approaching it as a designer when you're trying to sculpt like a larger ecosystem, because regardless of what people happen to be using, like even though nobody did that great with IG in the last tournament, ICP tournament, right? Like we still know he's good, even though mm-hmm. that wasn't part of that tournament's metagame. We know he's good and we're keeping him in mind as an example. So that's kind of my high-level take on the whole topic.
It is actually really interesting to point out that what things are available in the game and what things communities think are good can be very different. So we talked last time about how, you know, high-profile players can actually influence what people think is meta in certain regions, right? And we actually have one of the designers here with us, or several of the designers here with us today. And we can think a little bit about the interplay between things that they've designed that they think is good, but the wider community doesn't adopt, right? I'm sure, you know, whoever made Lothcats way back in the day thought they were going to be great and were really disappointed that nobody played them for a long time. And that doesn't mean things are not strong necessarily. It just means that they're not common or not considered known by the community.
Correct, and I do think that spreading into that same vein, because the IACP community, or at least the online Vassal community, I mean, let's not kid ourselves, it's not the largest in the world. So a lot of the time we'll have a new tournament and we realize, oh well, wow, a lot of these new cards were unplayed. For example, the Scout Troopers don't see a lot of play in tournaments. Does that mean the Scout Troopers are bad? No, not at all. They have arguably one of the most powerful defensive abilities in the game, but they have a very specific playstyle. And every single IACP season, there are a lot of cards which are released which appeals towards very specific playstyles. You can contrast the Royal Guards and the Scout Troopers. The Royal Guards obviously very defensive, very close range, and very, very deadly as a Guardian, whereas Scout Troopers are the complete opposite. They are a lot easier to kill,
They can shoot at very far ranges if you, you know, maybe can focus them up with some sort of ability. And when you are able to give yourself the innate surge from exposed weakness and stuff like that. And that's just the thing, because you do have to consider the fact that you can't consider every single ICP card. If it's good, it's going to be played in the competitive meta. No, we don't have enough players, and not everyone is going to want to run different things. You know, a lot of people will want to say, well, you know what, I love Boba, so I'm going to run Boba. That doesn't mean that Boba is the only good thing coming out of Season 3, for example.
Yeah, I think popularity actually just plays a role. The cool factor as well.
Mm-hmm. All the Timmies coming out from within.
Exactly.
Okay, so before we actually talk about meta and tactics and mechanics, actually, there is one big point that I would like to bring up first, and that's efficiency. So we are going to have a lot of ideas presented within this episode, but do keep in mind that everything does have an efficiency in terms of health, damage, movement speed, and whatever you're paying for special abilities. The kind of reality is that a unit has to be efficient in order to be competitive, no matter how great the mechanics are. So I know actually that both Jake and Noah have paid a lot of attention to efficiency. I've read a lot of Twin Troopers articles actually analyzing units as they've come out. So Jake, do you want to give us your thoughts on this?
What you'll see is efficiency is often tied to what is the most effective tactics available because it's consistent. So you'll see people going off about the efficient units are the most effective because they're the most consistent. Whereas, so if you'll look at, say, a Vader is consistently putting out a lot of damage versus something with a little less consistency, but with a high ceiling. So you could...
Swingy units
that are capable of doing... having a big effect on the game, but aren't as consistent about it. If they go off right, then you're likely to win the game. But if it doesn't go off correctly, then you just fizzle and die. So in a tournament where you have to win consistently for 7 rounds to get into the top cut, and then if you want to win the whole thing, you then have to win 4 more games in a row. In those cases, the swingy lists aren't going to be as good as your consistent list with your Weequays or your Vaders or stuff like that. Purely because of the fact that you're likely to lose games if things don't go off perfectly, if you don't draw the right command cards.
That's a good point. So basically, the unit has to kind of have a high enough floor for whatever it's rolling in most circumstances. But it also needs to be somehow reliable, because if you can't count on it delivering a specific type of benefit as you're playing, it cannot be efficient.
And I think a great example of this is, does the figure have a red die? And does the figure have a reroll? If it's got either or, okay, they're pretty good, not bad. If you got a red die with no reroll, you're going to cry a lot of games. Have a red die and a reroll, you're swinging happy, which is why Vader is, again, just like Jake said, one of the strongest melee figures in the game, because you got 2 red dice, which just increases your consistency, and you got a reroll.
I think a great unit to bring up here is Jedi Luke, actually, who, while he's capable, like, if Jedi Luke goes off well, such as I've seen when I've played him in Amigos a lot, if he goes off well, you basically win the game because you're able to get in 4 large-ish attacks, but also his dice pool, you're very capable of just rolling triple surge or rolling 1 damage, 2 surges, or some very low amount. And when that happens, you just wasted 11 points. But when he goes off correctly, when you roll well with him consistently, you can annihilate entire games in the second round. So I've had some very good successes with Jedi Luke, but overall he's not as good as the more consistent units like your Hans or your Vaders, because he doesn't have that insurance like a reroll or having a red die, which 5 times out of 6 is going to roll a decent result or better. But since he's rolling less consistent dice than red, he's just not that good.
To bring a more high level view on the efficiency discussion. So Imperial Assault is an asymmetrical game with symmetrical costs. Right. Everybody has to only 40 points to work with, and they only have 15 command cards and 15 points to work with in their command deck. But other than that, everybody's bringing different things to from their side to fight against the other side. So efficiency is just like, how well are you using those resources that you've been given that are the same as your opponent? And are you able to generate more value from those resources than your opponent is? So that's why efficiency is so important, because it really is just whoever can take the same resources they've been given as the other player and generate more value from them, because that's what efficiency is. It's value to cost. It's how much value are you creating for the cost that you're paying for them.
We've talked about value. We've talked about the things that are good. But the second part that you just mentioned there is the cost. So the cost plays a really big role in efficiency, because you might have a unit that's amazing, very consistent, rolls well, but if the point cost is too high, it loses its efficiency.
Exactly.
Especially if we then consider those are points that you would give up if that figure dies, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because the extra points you're paying for it, those could have gone to another figure that would generate even more value. So there's a cost to that. And there's also hidden costs as well that people don't think about. Things like positioning costs, situational costs, those people don't think about as much, but they are a cost that you have to pay because you're less flexible in what you could do. So there's opportunity cost there of where you could have positioned if you weren't trying to use this ability that otherwise forces you to be somewhere you don't want to be.
Right. So not only are units that are more consistent, more efficient, and not just lower point costs, but also flexibility, right? Can you use them in more situations? That's going to be better efficiency as well.
Yep.
Yeah, these are really great points. So kind of how much you have to pay for something and whether it has conditional triggers,
mm-hmm.
we'll talk about a little later how these things affect whether or not a specific example of one of the mechanics we've got in Imperial Assault is considered really strong or too weak to include in your list.
Yeah, final thing I want to say is that we're going to be talking about all these tactics and which ones are kind of better than others or more useful, but it really comes down to efficiency. So you could have a tactic that is low on our list, but if it's super hyper efficient, it's going to be probably the best, even better than the other one. So there's a kind of a ranking of abilities and type and categories, but efficiency is kind of like the decider on what's really good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So why don't we just jump into discussing some of these mechanics that are very powerful in Imperial Assault. So most of these things will somehow break the flow of the game or break some of the game's basic rules. In Imperial Assault, you basically have a number of activations and you take turns activating units. Each figure can only shoot once with its two actions, and it can move a number of movement points equal to its speed. It needs to have line of sight to hit something, right? So a lot of the things that we're going to talk about now are how you can break these basic rules and get a lot more out of your units than it looks like at face value. So the first thing, sort of theme that we have is activation manipulation. How certain mechanics can add, chain, swap entire activations in the game.
The reason I have activation here at the top of the list is, so last activation is part of it. It's not the most powerful though, but I'm going to get into that. Last activation means that you have perfect information on the board with the final activation of the round. So it's really important for stuff like Han, because it means his end of round shot, you're going to have perfect activation. Your opponent's not going to be able to like counter your end of round shot with anything. Same thing with Vader. But it's also really important because it leads into the next thing, which is the ability to take the last activation and then go into taking the first activation on the next round. That's like a subpart of the really powerful tactic, which is activation chaining, which is where you chain activations back to back and your opponent doesn't get a chance to respond. That's why Take Initiative is so powerful, right? Is because every time you play Take Initiative, either you are setting up an activation chain where you had the last activation and then you're going to get the first one, or you're breaking a chain where if your opponent had the last activation last round, you're not going to let them take the first activation in the next round. So Take Initiative is always either giving you an activation chain or breaking an opponent's activation chain. And chaining activations is so powerful because it's a tempo advantage, but it also means you get to stack a bunch of damage onto one figure before your opponent can react to prevent that.
I think another reason it's really important as well is you can get value out of your figures and still be able to get them back to safety again. So that's also, if you play kind of defensively and use that in that way, you can then deny value to your opponent because they don't get the opportunity to take figures off of the board if you put them in a risky position.
Yeah, so very, very simply, this is extremely powerful because it takes away your opponent's chance to respond, right? Imperial Assault is an I go, you go kind of back and forth swap of activating units. And if you can get the last activation and then the first activation, you've broken that fundamental rule.
Precisely. And I do think that another reason why high activation count is an incredibly powerful and effective tactic is just because of the obvious reason that you have a lot of figures on the board, and that is going to help you in one of a variety of different ways. For example, if you're running a Jawa Swarm, you are likely going to 10 or 11 activations. That means you've got 6 Jawas on the board, which means you have 6 attacks in addition to all of your other hunters who are going to be running around and shooting like crazy. If you're running a Rebel list and maybe running Han Rangers and you go to 9 activations or maybe even 10 activations, you will likely be having Hera, R2, Gideon, 3PO. And essentially the thing I want to identify here is that if you have a list with a large amount of activations, it means you will have more tools available to either buff your queen pieces or serve as a distraction, and they can do their own work, such as smugglers or Jawas. They don't really buff Han or Rangers or IG or Boba or anything like that. They do their own work.
Now, I personally actually don't prioritize having a large number of activations because I take advantage of being able to pass, because I find being able to go later on in the round is valuable because I get more information about what my opponent is trying to do. Now, it's a little bit negated by Rebel Care Package because it's kind of give me what they're kind of going to do. You don't really get an information advantage, but that's one way that I can kind of deal with a list that's higher in activations than me, is that passing rule I can take advantage of.
Well, Jess, you'll never be able to get last activation for that round with that perfect information unless you use another activation tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Or Lion Ambush. But that's another story.
Everybody always forgets about Sit Tight. I also wanted to add that I played a lot of games against Patrick Christian's Jawa Swarm, and the weakness of these high activation count lists is that their reliance on small figures that can be easily killed in one or two hits means that they're very vulnerable, and once they lose that activation count, there's not really much behind it. Or in my games against Han Rangers, is if you can find a way to get around, once you kill 2 Rangers, you've basically won if you haven't lost an extensive amount of your list doing it.
Yeah, so a high activation count is not a strength unto itself. It's something that is only good if you have like a figure, a really powerful figure that with perfect information can do a ton of damage to an opponent that can't react to it. Like Han Solo, the Rangers are a big activation. IG-88 is a good example, and Vader is a good example. That's why we are very cautious about, especially Vader, because his end of round attack and his regular attack, if he can do that both at the end of a round without the opponent being able to react, is very powerful.
Right. I think something else we can point out is that high activation count is a generally good idea, but what you really want is just one more activation count than your opponent, right? If you're running a list and your opponent's got 5 activations and you've brought 11, your combat units are probably a lot weaker than theirs. Whereas if you had 6 activations, you would still be able to pull off that last first swing, and you would have most likely beefier figures on the board.
I do also think that the extent to which a large amount of activations is helpful is very dependent on the fact of how much does a figure need to be buffed. Vader is a figure who doesn't need that much support. You know, give him 2 block tokens from extra armor, and maybe just give him a couple of tokens every now and then from Thrawn, and he's good to go. He will definitely get you back your 13 points if you play him correctly. Whereas if you contrast that with Han is someone you need a lot of points to help him out. You need someone to help him draw lamb. You need someone to help him focus, to stand next to him with 3PO to give him an extra block and evade. So I do think that a high amount of activations is going to be useful to different extents, depending on your queen piece or how it is you're playing.
Let me just summarize this one. So for activation count, just to give people the tools that they can use to achieve that, if they have something like Han or IG or Rangers in their list, cheap figures like 2-point officers, Jawas, Lion Smugglers, using Rebel Care Package instead of Jabba to get 2 activations instead of the 1. And then Devious Scheme is another card you can use because it forces your opponent to take initiative. So if you're tied on activations, you will get the last activation for that round, for the first round.
Right. And in order to achieve this activation chaining effect, you can go for this last first swing with take initiative and negation, but you can also just play cards like strength and numbers, squad swarm, and combine them with effects like Jabba's order hit, for example, to get back-to-back attacks. Other things that add similar effects could be Spectre Cells card or Provoke, so card effects that make your opponents activate something else that they wouldn't have.
Yep, multi-figure groups as well. So Rangers and Weakways rely on this activation chaining as part of their big strength, even though they're just 2 dice figures.
Exactly. Okay, great. And then, of course, we have the real kind of trump card of manipulating activations, and that's just ways of giving figures more activations.
I think Jake should talk about this one. This is all 3 amigos, right?
Yeah, so that's for those who aren't aware, I was known back in the day for a list called 3 Amigos, which was Jedi Luke, IG-88, Onar, who are the 3 amigos, and they're backed up by R2-D2, C-3PO, and an elite Jawa, and then a 1-point upgrade. So with that list, what I would do is I would just run in, I would use the Luke and IG, and then they had access to Son of Skywalker and Blaze of Glory, which would allow them to have multiple activations within one round and could manipulate that. That's a way to ensure last activation. So if I could move in IG-88 on my last activation and then use Blaze of Glory to get another activation after that, then I would be able to annihilate an opponent's list without them being able to respond effectively. Again, that's if everything went according to plan. Going back to my earlier point of it's not a very consistent list. When it goes off beautifully and I win in the second or third round. If it doesn't go off, if I don't draw those cards, or if my Luke attacks crap out, or IG-88's attack can crap out pretty easily too. If any of those things happen, then I'm basically out of the game and I lose in the second or third round. It was a very fun list to play, but it was inconsistent. But one of the stealth advantages of this list was that since I won or lost each game in half an hour or less, I had a lot of time to rest between rounds. So I would be more mentally alert than my opponents, especially going to the later rounds.
These cards basically just turn up the activation count and the chaining aspects to 11, because you basically get to do 3 activations in a row if you have last activation with Luke or IG, and then you place on a Skywalker to get another activation right away. And then if you have an initiative going in the next round, you're activating 3 times with these figures that can each do 2 attacks on their activation for 6 attacks total, and they're all 3 dice attacks. It's devastating.
I don't think I ever got it off, but it would be possible to do an activation, Son of Skywalker, then Blaze off of that, or in the opposite order, and then have first activation. You could get 4 highly effective, huge activations in a row.
That's insane. And that's why these are so devastating. So I also have Call the Vanguard here as another example. Even though it's not technically an activation, you can do the same thing where if you have end of round with like a trooper, like especially with like Fenn Cygnus and the Rebel side, you could go last with Fenn, play Call the Vanguard, get another attack with him, and then get first activation. That's another triple activation chain.
Yeah, or Captain Taro.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, with Captain Taro. Yep, it's super devastating on him. Anything that has 3 dice, really, including the jets. We also have Debts Repaid and Furious Charge that do this, but that has those costs that we're talking about earlier. So debts, your opponent has to attack and kill one of your non-Chewbacca figures. Furious Charge, you can only use it if your opponent does 3 damage to your Garcon. So while those aren't always too hard to set up, you don't have perfect control over them the way you do with Son of Skywalker and Blaze. So they're not quite as strong, but the fact that they give you another activation still makes them worth considering in any list that can play them.
Yeah, I think they're definitely weaker because not only do they have this condition that you've got to meet, but the figures that they let you reactivate have fewer attacks than Luke and IG, right?
Exactly. The last thing about activations is, so I call this activation swapping. It's basically when you can do something like Son of Skywalker, but it costs another figure basically its whole activation. There's a few cards that do this. New Orders for Leaders. It's a double action to ready an adjacent figure. Kyle Bossom actually uses this card quite a lot to great effect with, you know, using an officer to ready a Vader. Like, that's a great trade. Yeah. So even though you're trading one activation for another, it's not a symmetrical activation trade. You know, you're happy to give up an officer activation to be able to activate Vader again.
Especially when you consider some of the leaders that we have in the game right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Emperor could use new orders, and because of his static abilities, Palpatine can activate, he can tempt someone for a damage and a damage power token. He can then play new orders to ready someone standing next to him, and he can then order them to perform an attack if there is someone in range.
And then the other examples of this are, I have Change of Plans. This card actually used to see a lot of play when troopers were a big thing, because if you had a trooper group that had gone down to one figure, you would exhaust that one to ready another trooper group that was at full strength. And again, that was kind of that, like, you're happy to trade one trooper's activation to get three more. But now it doesn't see as much play except in, like, Han Jedi Luke lists, or Han Chewie, I guess. And then Kane Somos has a command card. He has to spend an action, and he can ready another trooper group. And the fact that it costs an action means he's probably going to be giving up most of his activation, since he usually has to move to get into position to either use firing squad or make his attack. Those cards, not quite as strong, but they give similar options.
Yeah, so that, I think that about covers it for activation manipulation. I mean, which is an incredibly strong mechanic, but there aren't too many examples in the game. There are a good number, but it's not overly abundant, I would say. So the second kind of big category of incredibly powerful mechanics is this sort of perfect information damage control, as Noah would call it. So basically ways where you can add damage or deal damage after you know everything that's going to happen. So this means that it's not dependent on a dice roll.
This perfect information damage control is very powerful because, I mean, it all comes back to consistency. If you're not going to make the kill, you don't have to play your assassinate. If you're not going to die, you don't have to use your Zillow tap. If you can't prevent the death, you don't have to use the Zillow tap. It's being able to go in with the perfect information to tell exactly how much resources you need to invest into something, as compared to reroll effects, as compared to things that add dice at the beginning of the attack. Those abilities won't matter as much. They're less consistent, is what I'm trying to say. If you reroll a dice, sure, you're going to go up 83% of the time if you reroll a red one damage, but sometimes it just stays there. In my cases, it's usually half the time it stays there.
Back to efficiency and what we were talking about before is that if you are able to see the roll first before you can put in resources, it saves you your resources. The cost is lower versus ICP has done some changes where you have to play cards in different windows.
On the lamb change, where you go from seeing whether or not you dodge to having to use it before you dodge. And on the lamb, I think, should probably just be straight up banned, but the community doesn't want that. but yeah, just moving on the lamb from perfect information damage control to blind damage control, aka before seeing whether or not you'll die from an attack, is a big example of the power that perfect information damage control can add.
Yeah, another big one is like comparing tools to assassinate. The other side of perfect information damage control is blind damage, where you're just adding things before you get to see the dice. And the reason those are weaker is because if you put a bunch of stuff in one basket, if you play tools and death blow on your Ezra attack that's focused, and then your opponent rolls a dodge or has on the lamb, that's a big blow, and that's something you wouldn't have done if you had seen that dodge previously. I personally really like, as a designer, I would like blind dice manipulation on cards because I find it helps to balance a lot of that stuff. Whereas when you can just add things after the fact without having to take any risk, I find it's less interesting and it becomes too powerful. So stuff like assassinate, positioning advantage, those are all very easy to play because all you have to do is count the symbols on the dice and be like, oh, I need this much more damage. Here's my assassinate. You don't have to actually think ahead of time.
I think the best example of this distinction between perfect information and blind is the element of surprise versus heightened reflexes. So element of surprise and heightened reflexes more or less do the same thing. Element of surprise does it before anything is rolled. Heightened Reflexes does it after and can only be played by hunters, but is still so much stronger. Just because, you know, you use it when you have to, you don't waste it.
When you element to get rid of a white die because you fear the dodge, you never know if they were going to blank. You just can't know
right,
that.
Yeah, right. I like what Noah was saying about, as a designer, the blind dice manipulation, damage manipulation is more interesting. It involves more strategy. You have to really consider when you're going to use it. And there is that little element of risk, and you kind of have to then think through your risk mitigation profile. Versus if you have perfect information, it's like, oh, of course I play it here. It's like just playing by script.
So I'm actually going to challenge that idea a little bit, because at least from my stance, I consider a effect to be very, very fun when I know what value I'm going to get out of it. I mean, I'm not going to get into it again, but I've spoken at length about how I play Han Rangers, and it's all about guaranteed, guaranteed, guaranteed. If a effect is one which I can only use once, but it means that I get to know my actions, it means that my maximum performance level goes a lot higher, just like we know that the maximum damage ceiling would go higher as well. The reason I don't think that it's less fun, or less, I'm not sure the exact word used, that the effect is known, the reason for that is that I find it fun when I can execute my strategy whilst knowing what's going to happen, and then either winning or losing the game accordingly. What I don't find fun is saying, well, this is my strategy, I'm going to do the best I can, but if the dice say no, I lose. That's just not really what, it just comparing the two extremes, that's just not really what I would consider a fun, especially as a tournament player. I'm not going to run something at a tournament I actually want to win if it's something which, well, I mean, it might do something for me or it might not. No, I'm going to run it if I think it gives me a combo which will win me the tournament.
So, Isaac, let me clarify just a little bit, because I agree with you that's why I have perfect information more powerful than blind. That's what I was trying to say. And I totally agree with you that for the person using these abilities, it's way more fun, I guess you could say, to have perfect information, because that gives you full agency. I was saying, as a designer, it's less fun for your opponent when that happens. And your opponent feels better when you are having to take a risk to get a very powerful ability versus when you get to just play something on them with perfect information. It's more, I'm talking about more like fun for opponent versus fun for the player. And that's why, as a designer, like, I'm thinking about not just is this fun for someone to play, but is this going to be fun for someone to play against?
Yeah, exactly. So I do agree with that, Noah. However, I would still say that I would rather win or lose to my opponent playing something which is guaranteed and them playing it well or not, rather than them saying, you know, there are some other games which, you know, they'll have a card which say roll a die, and if you roll a six, you can do this effect. You know, I wouldn't really find it more fun if my opponent had if I won my game because my opponent had their strategy flawed because their dice messed up.
I want to add on to both of those points. To Noah's point is that we need to take into account the opponents as well, as because as game designers, we want everybody at the table to have fun, not just the people playing the units we design, but we want it to not be a negative play experience for the people on the other side. You want to avoid things where it just feels like you won or lost the game on pure luck. However, to counteract that point is, you were saying you have most fun with cards and figures and effects that are guaranteed. But speaking purely for myself, I really like the variable effects that when they go off big. So because I get a bigger rush out of having something unlikely happen that then you jump up off the table and start jumping around because you got that last important dodge, or having too much fun because you drew the perfect command card combo that lets you take that four activations in a row. Like, your opponent's probably not having much fun if, say, Amigos goes off perfectly like that, but it's memorable and something that's going to they're going to remember for a long time. Or you get effects that are more luck reliant, like on the minor end, the Elite Jawas gambling ability to just roll a green die and maybe go up, maybe stay the same, maybe go down, who knows. But those kinds of situations where the anticipation and the not knowing exactly what's going to happen can add a lot of fun to a game as well. So we need to make sure to, when designing, to cater to both audiences.
And I'll just say, Isaac, I'm really glad that you said that and brought that up, because, you know, even though Jake and I feel a certain way about this, like, it's good to know that certain players feel differently, and it's good that we have different perspectives on the committee. That means we can always be advocating for the different player types and designing cards for one player and another player and not ignoring people. There are people like you, Isaac, that just want everything to be perfect information with low bearing. But there's also people who aren't like that, and we can design for both types of players.
Precisely, which I do think is just great.
I don't think there's a fundamental kind of antagonism between these two ideas. I think that a lot of players do want perfect information effects. And I am one of those, so I tend to agree with Isaac in that I find managing your resources and spending them, say, on the right kill much more satisfying than getting a lucky roll, for example. But in terms of IACP and designing forward, designing blind effects, I think, would add a lot more to the game than adding more perfect information effects.
Because they exist already.
Yes, because we do have a lot of perfect information effects already. And I actually don't think it's healthy for an entire list to only rely on these. You should be able to have kind of 50% of your resources in this really manageable, kind of safe way. But the rest of it should have some sort of reliance on dice and the other core mechanics of Imperial Assault, right? When you want to kill something, you roll some dice. You don't need all your tools to skip that mechanic entirely.
And blind dice just introduces risk management. That's all we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's perfect information gives you, it's like a resource management. Blind dice adds risk management on top of that, which is a skill.
Yeah, definitely. So in order to kind of paint the picture of how much of these effects there are in the game, Noah, why don't you just give us a quick, you know, rapid fire list of all the perfect information damage control we've got.
Yeah, sure. So this includes not just dice attack modifiers, but really anything that can add damage, deal damage to someone without having to roll dice also qualifies under this. So especially if it doesn't cost an action. So like Palpatine's Tempt, Ezra's Much to Learn with a Force user, because it's basically just adding damage onto his roll. Assassinate is the one we all know about. Heightened, we talked about. Positioning advantage is just a mini assassinate. Hera, that's like just another positioning advantage type of effect, but you can add a surge with it. Grizzly, Contest, and Force Surge are letting you deal damage without having to see what kind of dice are being rolled. Drakata, her Demolish adds deals a damage. Sabine's Grenade, that has a dice roll, but you're pretty guaranteed 5 out of 6 to get 1 damage. Overrun, Cleave is another form of this. And then defensively, we also have Perfect Information Mitigation, which is just the mirror side of damage. So Onar's Get Down. Zillow Technique is the huge one, because it's in every Imperial list. Oh, Miracle Worker is actually, I consider this, because you get to see it happens like at the very end of the attack after all the dice and modifiers, and just undoes whatever damage they were going to deal. Jet Troopers have Agile. The tank has Defensible. We have a bit of a controversial one here. So Iron Will, the Guardian card, I actually consider this to be a blind dice ability, because you don't know how much damage your opponent's attack was going to deal. But somebody put it on the perfect information.
Yes.
I disagree with that, because you guarantee your figure stays on the board.
Correct. And that was basically my point as well. So I'm the one who put it on the sheet. And okay. I consider it one of the very, very, very few abilities which fall into both categories. It is blind, just because for the fact that dice have not been rolled yet. But it is also perfect, because you know that your 4 health left figure will survive the attack, regardless of rolls, regardless of cards. So it's basically, I see it falling into both categories, because it gives you a guaranteed effect, which, you know, it might not fulfill that whole effect, because the attack might do worse. So with Iron Will, you're capped at taking 3 damage. Yes, you could take less, that is possible, but if your figure is, again, very close to death at 4 health left, this is a card which I would say is perfect information, because regardless of what your opponent does, it will go off as the way you want it.
We have to be careful about calling it perfect and blind, because you remember, as the defender in Imperial Assault, you have a lot more information by the time it gets to your window to play cards than the attacker does anyway. So I would say it's almost like a half information.
That I will go with. The fact that you get to see all your opponent's command cards on their attack and then play Iron Will, that is a form of perfect information. But if they're just doing a regular attack, they could whiff and do like 1 or 2 damage, and then you basically discarded your 3-point card for nothing. So
yeah.
I'll totally go with it being a half and half. Sure.
Yeah. And then we obviously have a lot of blind dice manipulation effects, right?
Yeah.
So these are some of the ones that we were talking about earlier, where you have blind dice manipulation, where you have to add things or subtract things before you see the results of the roll. So you get your brace for impact, your stealth tactics. Brace yourself actually would add onto that because it's played at beginning of the attack, if I remember correctly. But focus, tools, death blow, anything that adds dice or damage or subtracts dice or damage before the dice are rolled. Anything in the declare dice area. And also rerolls are also something that fall in between there, because while you're not guaranteed the specific results you're looking for, you do get to reroll after seeing what the dice results are. So you can choose not to reroll and not risk a tough luck if you see that you're already going to kill the defender, for instance. These are effects that just basically occur in the reroll or declare phases of the attack.
Also, a big one is power tokens before you roll dice. It'd be way different if you could spend them after you rolled dice.
Right. I'm seeing that there's some cards that are on here that aren't on the list, but I don't think it really matters. Like, anybody who knows the game decently well would be able to tell which cards fall into which category just based off of what phases it falls in and what information is available when you would play the card.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if we think about IACP design stuff, knowledge and defense falls into the blind category because you add a dice to the defense roll, right?
Absolutely. It's just more efficient at doing what it does than something like brace or stealth tactics, because you can use it multiple times. So that, again, into the efficiency thing.
Mm-hmm. And another IACP change is with the lamb change, which we discussed.
Yep. I feel like if you go back, I always wonder if you change assassinate to just forcing them to play it before dice are rolled, like, would that change it? But then I think 3 damage is still just so much, so it probably wouldn't make that as big of a difference as the change that they did implement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, let's move on to the next category. So if you can't increase your damage by a huge amount to take out a key figure, you can always just attack more, right? So normally figures can only attack once during their activation, but we've got a ton of effects that let figures attack more times, more other figures. You know, sometimes you've got this brutality thing going on with Vader or pre-upgraded Vader or the Rancor. So Isaac, why don't you take us through some types of extra attacks and how these work.
This next section refers to any figure or any effect which allows you to perform an attack either outside of your activation or outside of your usual attack. So a great example here would be Han's end of round shot and also Han's return fire shot. Han could attack 3 times a round pretty consistently if you buff him up and your opponent makes the questionable life choice of attacking him repeatedly. Yet another example of this for the Empire would be Vader. And Vader is actually an example for a multitude of different reasons. One, he is an Imperial figure, which means that he can directly benefit from Palpatine's Emperor ability, where he gets the extra attack. He also has his end of round effect, where he gets to either perform a force choke or an extra attack. In addition, he has access to cards such as Parting Blow.
He has access to Parting Blow and to Dying Lunge, and as well as his end of round attack.
Exactly. And then in addition to that as well, this is what we would kind of consider an attack replacement, because he has the Force Choke ability, which is a special action, choose a figure in your line of sight, suffer 2 damage and take a strain. Because that does cost an action, that is likely going to cost his attack if he isn't able to somehow form an attack in his other action. Maybe you go face-to-face, or maybe you're already adjacent to a figure. So those are some examples.
A really big one that costs an action that you can use to kind of replace an attack is things like Grenadier and things like Flamethrower, because they are an action. But there are situations where they're better, mainly AoE. So you have quite a few effects where you might have a more limited damage, but if you can spread that out, it might be worth it to replace an attack in that way.
In a lot of these cases, those effects can actually be used alongside an attack. It's just rare that you get the opportunity to do right. So, right? These cards or attack replacements that you've just mentioned are made even stronger by activation manipulation. Because if you can get Vader up there to hit someone and force choke someone through manipulating the activations, then you've also multiplied your attacks on the round where you're able to use the attack replacement mm-hmm. as well. Noah, why don't you just quickly tell us about the three types of bonus attacks and why, you know, the differences between them.
In Imperial Assault, there's kind of three categories of bonus attacks you can get. The first one is within your activation bonus attack, which is the most powerful because it's the most concentrated tempo-wise. I mean, it's just like chaining activations. If you can chain attacks together before your opponent can react, that's super powerful. The other one would be like out of activation attacks. So these are bonus attacks your figure can get outside of its activation, which means that it's already attacked during its own activation, and then it, later activations, it can get bonus attacks. And then finally, we have attack replacements. And these are damaging abilities that cost an action. And so for most figures, if they can't get bonus movement points, they'll usually have to spend an action to move to get a line of sight or whatever. And then instead of using their attack, they'll use whatever this action is, like Force Choke or Grenadier. If we look at making multiple attacks within your own activation, like one of the best examples I can think of for this is Vader. Probably the most devastating thing you'll ever face in Imperial Assault, in my opinion, is when Vader is able to play something like face-to-face, so he can move up to you, attack you, then play Dark Energy or Looking for a Fight, then play Parting Blow to get a second attack, and then he still has an action left because he got free movement points from face-to-face to use Force Choke. When you get to use two attacks in one activation, especially for really hard-hitting figures, that's particularly devastating. Weak ways I actually have here because they kind of do the same thing. Since there's two of them, they get to attack twice in one activation. Same with Rangers. But, you know, that's their normal attack. Another example would be Vinto has his command card that lets him get a bonus attack on top of his two normal attacks. So his actually quick draw is a good example of that as well. And then Jedi Luke has heroic, Boba Fett has Mandalorian tactics to get his free attack. And these are all very powerful. If you think about it, like an extra attack is kind of like adding two dice to a normal attack because, you know, your opponent gets a defense dice, gets an extra defense dice. So that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, and it's clearly a really powerful way of increasing the effectiveness of a figure. So recently, ICP has given Biv an extra attack ability through his command card, right?
Yes.
Way to potentially buff up characters that are not very used or underpowered.
Yep. Out of activation attacks, these are really important. And I actually will talk about movement here as well, just because anytime you can activate or do something with a figure that has already activated, it can be really disorienting for your opponent because we're so used to thinking that, okay, that figure has activated. Now I don't really have to worry about it anymore. You know, I don't have to worry about it moving away or attacking me again because it's activated. Well, if they have Jabba or Palpatine, you know, you have to worry. That figure is still, it's like a dead snake that you still have to worry about biting you. Same thing with interrupts. If you kill Greedo, he gets to do parting shot. If you deal some damage to somebody and Onar is nearby, you might get hit by extra protection. Same thing with movement. If you're moving figures around, you might think, oh, that figure's sitting there, it can't move anymore, I don't have to worry about not getting a shot on it. And then Gideon, an officer, moves it into cover, and now you're like, oh shoot, I lost my opportunity.
Right.
Yeah, so it breaks that fundamental rule of figures being able to do stuff during their activation.
Yep. So I will say that as a designer, again, going back into design, like one of the tools we found really useful is either spending movement points, or if we want something to be tied to an action, but we don't want it to be so limiting, granting movement as part of that special action. Because we found that that kind of lets us be more granular with the action costs. Because if a figure has four movement points and we make it cost two movement points to use the ability, it's kind of like we made it cost half an action, which is nice if it's something that's not worth a full action. And then similarly, if we want it to be tied to a special action, if we give them one or two movement points on top of whatever the ability is, it's kind of like we gave them half of their action back. So that's something that we've been using a lot in our recent designs, I think.
I like that IACP addition because before, movement points was a resource that you saw used a lot in mission objectives, mm-hmm. but not so much with abilities for figures. And I think that's a really nice way to tune, like you said, the action economy.
I think spending movement points as a resource does get complex very quickly. It's like because it's an invisible resource. So if you're trying to track it for a bunch of different things. That's kind of a feedback we've gotten on Boba. I think we're leaning more towards like special actions that let you move, because it's easier to just track that than having to think, okay, how many movement points do I have left? I spent this many on moving. Now I'm going to spend this many on a flamethrower, like, et cetera. Like, so that's just stuff we think about on the committee.
That makes sense. I guess that adds a little bit to the burden of knowledge of your opponent, who needs to know how many movement points you're getting mm-hmm. and how much everything costs, just so they can keep track alongside you, right?
Yeah, it's also very illuminating for me why FFG designed it so that movement points must be spent immediately if it's not your activation, because otherwise, if you think about like just trying to track all these invisible movement points staying on figures outside of their activation, just sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we're coming to the fourth section of these mechanics. So basically time travel, so you can do lots of things per round that you're not supposed to do. You know, shoot a really big gun, shoot your normal gun a bunch of times. Or the last strategy is to shoot people from a place where they cannot shoot you. So this involves long range combat, or surprise movement, or moving your opponents around. Long range combat obviously means that your figure inherently can hit someone from farther away than they can hit you, which means that you can shoot them and run away and they won't be able to catch up and make a return shot. And then we've got two types of resources that you can include in your list that will help you increase your movement or to move friendly or hostile figures around.
So I've seen this being really popular in the tournaments recently, especially the movement of your opponent's figures. Well, actually, Diala has the flexibility of she can actually move her own figures as well. And Gideon has always been popular. Officers for Imperial are really strong for this moving figures around, especially figures that are slow. So I think this is really important in the meta.
Yeah, agreed. So I remember actually when I first started playing Imperial Assault, I was reading articles on the FFG website, and one of them was, of course, our extremely famous multiple world champion, Dan Taylor, talking about what kinds of cards and effects he thinks are strong. And he basically said that he really loves things that give you extra movement because it lets you do surprising things. It increases your reach. It really helps you attack your opponent without them being able to counter you.
Yeah. Something we haven't talked about really as well is mission objectives. I find this is really important for controlling the map, and especially for missions where you need to be in a lot of different places in order to get points, or you need to be in a specific place to get points, this can be really, really important. And I've been finding that this is getting a lot of play right now. Like Boba Fett is really, really strong, and we've seen him a lot. Diala is getting quite a lot of play. So we're seeing a lot of these effects right now.
I kind of think of these kind of in the same way, but movement increaser is something that gives your figure the ability to move farther. Then pushing is the ability to push your opponent's figures around. I do consider pushing your opponent's figures around to be stronger. Like if you compare two cards that did the same amount of movement, pushing your opponent's figures is going to be more valuable than moving your own because it disrupts your opponent's positioning in a way that your other figures, all the other figures in your list, can benefit from. An example would be, so moving, like a movement increaser, so the three factions each have their own version of Heart of Freedom, Worth Every Credit, and Price of Glory. These are great because they give you two movement points very flexibly, and they also remove a harmful condition. So like if you're stunned, they'll free you up from that. Next we have the 0 point cards, so Urgency and Fleet-Footed. Urgency tends to see more play just because it gives you two more than normal, but Fleet-Footed has that flexibility that Urgency doesn't because it's not tied to an action. And Urgency, you have to spend the movement points all at once, and you can't interrupt that to do another action. Next would be Force Rush, similar to Heart of Freedom, gives you two movement points for a Force user, and that's flexible like Fleet-Footed, but it's inflexible because you have to use it at the start of your activation. So if you don't know if you need it right away, you might have to take a gamble. Beast Tamer and Retrofitting, these cards are the skirmish upgrades that give a lot of movement points to specific figures, so creatures in mercenary lists and three specific vehicles in Empire lists. And then finally, I consider mobile to be a movement increaser just because It doesn't give you extra movement, but if you're moving through terrain that would normally cost more movement to move through, like if you had to spend extra points to move around a blocking terrain, you're basically getting free movement points by ignoring that. So it's kind of like thinking about like how Han ran the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs, right? It's not because he went faster than the other people. It's because he did it in less movement than the other people did. So mobile definitely helps with increasing your movement. For push, we of course have Boba, his wrist cord. Onar has rush, which includes damage. That should have been in the perfect information damage section. Oh well. Diala has her force push. Chewie has slam, which pushes one space. Shyla has her whip. Forlom has it as a surge ability. Then for command cards, we have force push for rebels, dark energy for Imperial force users, and then looking for a fight for brawlers. So I also consider like any push ability that you don't have to get adjacent to your target. So Shyla, Diala, Boba, Forlom, they're very strong because you don't have to put your figure at as much risk, but it's still very powerful even with stuff like Onar, Chewie. Those are a little less powerful because when you do it, you're putting your figure at risk, even though you're able to maybe put your opponent's figure in greater danger. But being able to push an opponent's figure off of an objective, or like in the case of a recent game, my opponent was using Onar very effectively to deny my Yoda like deflection ability and like to deny things like 3PO's, you know, all that kind of positioning stuff is very disrupted by push in a way that just moving your opponent, moving their friendly figures around doesn't do as much. So
going off of that, one time I used Onar to push an activated Ranger away from Murn to prevent new orders. But so just, you can use these push abilities to really mess with your opponent's plans a lot, which is why I think it belongs at the top of this list, or just dragging people out into the open. So if somebody like Isaac is trying to keep their Ranger or Han in a very specific place, it just really messes with your opponent's positioning game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, push is the biggest enemy of sniper lists, without a doubt.
Yeah, and I'll also share with you kind of my perspective on long range versus melee. I actually consider ranged attacks to be like a form of movement, because if you think about it, like if you think about a long range figure, like if it was a melee figure and you attacked a hostile figure that was like four spaces away, right? That means if you were a melee figure, you would have to move three spaces more and then move three spaces back to accomplish the same thing that a ranged figure did. So having a ranged attack actually gives you this huge reach that lets you extend it much further than a melee figure can. And for that reason, ranged figures tend to have a big advantage over melee figures in Imperial Assault, unless the melee figure is very balanced to either have a ton of movement points or have a really, really strong attack for when it does get into range.
Or if we have a map, perhaps, that reduces line of sight, right?
Yeah.
Because they do effectively have movement, but their movement has to be in straight lines where you can see two corners of your target's space.
Yes, very true. Yep. So like maps that have a lot of blocking terrain can limit their movement, so to speak, their eyesight movement, I guess.
Something I've noticed talking about push, actually, that relates really well to a couple of things you've said today, Noah, is that push is better than adding movement, sure. But a lot of this is actually because of how much information you have when you use the push. Mm. So if you push a figure that's already activated and you already know where your opponent wants them to be, it's incredibly strong, right? But if you had a push ability, which doesn't exist in Imperial Assault, maybe it will later after we've talked about it. If you had a push ability that could only move figures that have not activated, it immediately becomes a ton weaker.
Yeah, and it is definitely weaker if you're pushing something that hasn't activated yet. You know, your opponent can then react. You can also counter push with like out of activation movement, like we talked about earlier. So if they still have their officer or Gideon, they can counter your push that way. Okay, guys, I actually have to sign off for now, but I'm going to let these excellent hosts take over, and then I'll send a sign off at the end of the show.
Thanks, Noah.
Yeah, thanks for coming up. All right, those are the main kind of mechanics that you can use to make your figures more effective at combat. But we have talked a lot about resource efficiency in general, and the next section is actually related to how you get more of your resources when you need them. Basically, manipulating command cards.
This wasn't the case at the beginning of the game where command cards were just more gravy, but nowadays command cards make or break a list. If you don't draw the command cards you need at the time you need them, you're more likely to lose. That means that figures like Jabba or R2-D2, who are able to consistently draw you more cards, are very valuable. And then there's also the other command cards and some skirmish upgrades that will draw you extra cards. But just the effect of being able to draw extra cards makes you more likely to win the game because you have more options available to you than your opponent does. Or you have better options available to you than your opponent does if you're both playing a lot of card draw, at least in theory. So command card draw, just all of the things that we were talking about before, a lot of it is dependent on command cards. So the ability to have more command cards than your opponent, get them into your hand, is just makes it all the more likely that you'll win. Contrary to that, or I guess corollary to that, is also the ability to control the command cards that your opponent is playing. So these are cards like Negation or Comms Disrupt that prevent your opponent from playing the cards in the first place, or Thrawn and Intel Leak that keep them from having the cards to be able to play at all. Also added to this would be Strain, which can mill your opponent's cards that before they get to play them. So just the ability to have more command cards and prevent your opponent from using them enables everything else that we've been talking about this entire episode.
Yeah, especially because a lot of these command cards give you those incredibly strong extra activations, right?
Yeah.
If you can get your Blaze of Glory and Son of Skywalker in Three Amigos in round one, you're going to have a good day. But if your opponent manages to intel leak or get rid of them, you're gonna have a very bad day.
A lot of my lists that I build do get me a lot of extra command cards, and so I despise spy cards specifically because of how they mess with that plan. So a lot of the time in a scum list, I'll be sitting there with 7 or 8 cards in hand at the beginning of round, or at the beginning or in the middle of round two. And then my opponent will come in with a strat shift, put me down to 2, and then intel leak after that to get rid of the best of those 2. And then I'm sitting at 1 card in a hunter's list with nothing to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that is why, in my opinion, I consider spies to be the best trait in the game. And that's probably a little bit controversial because obviously you got the insane cards such as Assassinate for Hunters, Lamb for Smugglers, Iron Will for Guardians, but Spy is the only trait which you can introduce as a splash into any list and still get more or less the exact same value out of it, because you just need one figure. You need one figure, 2 or 3 cards in your deck, and you just need to draw them. Whereas Hunters, Hunter is only the best keyword or the best trait in a Hunter list. Guardian is only the best in a Guardian list.
Yeah, that synergy.
Exactly, exactly. Whereas Spies is going to work with anything and will always do the same amount of work for you. It'll obviously depend on what your opponent is running, because Hunters care about command cards more than others do.
I would agree it is a very strong trait, but I think what puts it down for me from being the best is Jake's kind of discussion about reliability, I guess. If you're playing against an Imperial player, they don't care that much. So that means against some matchups, you're not getting the same value out of your spies as you would against other matchups. So it is variable, right? It's not so consistent. And especially if you are an Empire player as well, putting Spy Splash into your list is less powerful because you are much less likely to draw those spy tools that you would then use to disrupt your opponent. I mean, you always feel silly with your Spy Splash if you don't draw any of them at all for the entire game.
Yeah. Right. And if I can dogpile onto that a little bit more, is I would fight the spy as the best trait because the spies are generally not the most efficient figures. So you're talking about a spy splash. You're probably talking about Mac Eshkaray in a Han Rangers list, but Mac Eshkaray is not a very effective fighter versus what you could, well, I guess there's not much more for 3 points, but it's 3 points that you couldn't use to upgrade, say, something else into a better fighter. So you're still kneecapping yourself a little bit on the pure efficiency standpoint.
Yeah, but maybe not for long.
yeah, exactly. That is definitely a fair point. And I do want to clarify that it was mainly in command cards I was meaning that. I obviously, if I'm referring to spies as figures, they're not something I would ring home about. But with the fact that their command cards can work with any other faction, I would say puts them definitely up there, because Hunters will work in a Hunter list. You can't really splash Hunters the same way you can splash a spy.
Speaking of IACP, are spies popular right now? I haven't seen them too much.
We have seen a lot of Ahsoka.
Oh, I forgot.
Ahsoka is everywhere, spying. That's on true. All the game. times.
How often does she, are they using the spy command cards with her, or are they using her because the Rebel Force user lists are popular where you're at?
If they've got her, they will always have the intel leak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That just made Ahsoka a slightly more powerful package on top of the 1 point reduction. I've seen her in lists without all Force users as well, just because she's pretty solid and brings the spy splash as well.
And then Sasuke as well, because Sasuke is used in a variety of different lists to bring in scum figures as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I stand corrected.
Well, soon we will have Loku.
Indeed.
Okay, you guys are all wrong, though. Clearly the best trait is droid.
Triangulate OP, please, Nuff.
I actually wanted to go off a little bit about that, because the droids have very little cohesion as a trait, but there are many droid figures that are amazing. You have your R2, your 3PO, IG-88. The sentry droids are pretty great, but they don't work well together, which for figures that in the fiction, they could all be networked together potentially, or have more efficient ways to communicate with each other. They just get stuck with nothing to work with each other around with.
I've tried to make a droid list a few times, and the synergy is very awkward.
The synergy is non-existent. You have to synergize around other traits that these droids have, like droid hunters with BT and IG.
Right.
They're incredibly hard to buff, though, because you have IG, BT.
Because you have very strong droids.
R2, 3PO, sentry droids that are top tier units already. It's hard to make them better.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the kind of last category that I've got written down here is victory point acceleration. So we've basically talked about how all of the other rules let you break the basic rules of the game by activating more than once, by making more than one attack, having more dice on your attacks, or manipulating the numbers. VP acceleration, though, sidesteps the entire combat phase of the game. So normally in Imperial Assault, the game tells you you get points by taking out your opponent's figures, or you get points by doing what the map tells you to do. With all of the VP cards, though, you basically say, no, I get points for sitting in the corner and drawing graffiti on the ground. And that is why it's so popular. You get straight to the end.
Cut out the middleman.
Yeah, you cut out the middleman and you just get your victory points. It is an effective mechanic to use if you can get enough of it.
As the primary punching bag for Jawa VP swarm, yes, it's super effective. It's basically stepping back from the game and looking at, so for a long time we got caught up in, oh, what are the best attackers? They're obviously hunters, or how do we circumvent around hunters, or how do we win in the combat phase of the game, or how do we win on the objective phase of the game? But stepping back and just realizing over the course of the game, there were many figures that were able to add victory points. With the Tyrants of Lothal expansion, we got that critical mass with Sabine and Hondo being added as attackers that also mess with victory points to go in and fight that battle. As Pat's primary punching bag, it's very scary to watch, especially where I've seen cases where one time he killed my Vader and got 23 victory points off of it.
No!
Yeah.
That's so gross!
It is. So just watching stuff like that, or just I'll check in and like, oh, what are the victory points? And he'll say some ridiculous, like at the end of round two, and it'll be like something ridiculous, like, oh, I have 17 victory points, and he has not killed a single one of my figures.
Oh, man.
I mean, I recall back when I was playing Gun VP, and I was at 17 points, threw one Sabine grenade, and got to 40 in one grenade.
Whoa.
Where just being able to rack up those victory points in ones or twos or threes over time, it all snowballs together, and the point of the game is not to kill your opponent's figures. The point of the game is not to hold objectives. The point of the game is to get to 40 points. That's it. And if you can circumvent everything else by just sending a swarm of Jawas out to contest objectives, have your Sabine and Hondo kill people, and then just play all of the victory point command cards, it's hyper effective, as seen by multiple victories of this strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing with victory point acceleration is it is really dependent on two things. One is the maps.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is how many people are playing command card control, because they're spending a lot of resources in their list to get these victory points and ignore the fighting aspect as much as possible. And if you can disrupt enough of that, they lose steam before they hit 40, you should have a big advantage.
That's easy to say in theory, but even when I was playing spy lists, like, there's more than enough command cards, victory point gain to be able to play around that.
I think it's really hard if the map gives those Jawas objectives to go for.
Exactly. So it's really dependent on map rotation too.
If you are playing on maps without many victory points that you can get every round though, and you can disrupt some of the either celebration or rebel graffitis, then you can make them run out of steam. But if they're on a good map and you're not able to do that, then just watch the little tickers go up without shooting anything. All right, so that is the list of what we consider to be the most effective tactics or mechanics to use to win the game in Imperial Assault. As a quick recap, you get yourself more activations. You just control how much damage you're doing per attack. You get yourself more attacks. You shoot your opponent from a position or distance at which they cannot shoot you back. You get yourself more resources than they have. Or you just give yourself points and forget about all of the rest of this. In terms of IACP going forward, you know, we already have all of these mechanics in the game. It would be really cool if you could comment a little bit on which mechanics we might want to see more of and which mechanics you probably will not create more of.
We're trying to avoid reinforcing the FFG meta and just giving people more of the same that they're used to playing. So every time we design an Imperial card, we're very careful around not improving the power of Vader. And we're trying to avoid the mistakes. We're trying to avoid creating cards that are too powerful. We're trying to avoid creating the next Spectre cell.
Sounds like a big focus then is to avoid power creep.
Yes, and we're trying hard to avoid it. It's hard to avoid sometimes, but that's what we're trying to do. And the community is overwhelmingly not in favor of walking back FFG's power creep through nerfing cards, trying very hard to maintain it at the current power level, which is a difficult design challenge, to say the least.
It is indeed. And I've definitely been, and just like we spoke about earlier, about having different voices on the committee who support different things, I'm usually the one who is the most skeptical about two things in particular. One, anything that will buff Guardians, because if you buff Guardians, you're going to buff Vader. If it's an ability which doesn't directly affect themselves, which is why Iron Will was created as a, well, let's make Guardians great without needing to even care about Vader anymore, because it just affects themselves.
Could you give us some examples of what mechanics you might be interested in doing more of rather than less of in the future?
We're really interested in basically trying to bring more variety to the gameplay. So we're always looking at ways to introduce new and interesting mechanics, such as messing with symbols in interesting ways, or by trying to tweak previous deployments that aren't as used anymore in ways that aren't just pure point reductions, although those are often, if something is a pure point reduction would be useful, then that's often what we want to look at first. But we might also look into changing them in ways to make them more interesting. I think Diala is a perfect example of this, where we changed her to have similar abilities to what she had previously, but to make them different enough in a way and more effective in a way that she'll actually see play, but also do something that we hadn't really seen before. So at the time that we released Diala, there wasn't an on-card ability to really push people around as effectively, to push people two spaces as we did with Diala's force push ability that was formerly on the command card.
Especially one that didn't use an action, right?
Yes. So stuff like that, where we try to bring old people back in a way that really makes them more effective. And we're always looking at older deployments that could be made better. And we're also constantly looking at what are people in Star Wars media that haven't had cards yet. So things like The Mandalorian or Rogue One, which never really had a chance to see play. Like in The Mandalorian's case, the game was dead when The Mandalorian came out. Or Rogue One, we only saw a couple of people out of Rogue One, the Death Troopers and stuff like that. So we just want to keep an eye on cards like that, that or abilities and units that haven't seen play yet much or at all, because they are just aren't in the game.
I'm definitely most excited about new content based on stuff that we haven't seen, like The Mandalorian or Rogue One or Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. That is really exciting to me.
I mean, it almost seems that IACP should not design more of anything we've talked about today, because all of these meta tactics and mechanics are the strongest ones in Imperial Assault that you want to stack if you want to win at, as it stands, right? And that just means that the more of these things you make, the less choice we'll have, because we'll want to keep stacking that extra activations. You know, if you make more Son of Skywalkers, I'm going to put more Son of Skywalkers in my deck. It's that good.
I'm kind of curious at this point. I might have to go on a rogue list building spree and just see how many reactivation cards I can get into one list.
I think it would be quite strong, actually, if you just go down this list and include as many things as you can. It's incredibly, incredibly powerful. So something I noticed that we didn't talk about was that if you take Onar and just look at the meta mechanics, Onar is almost in every single one, right? So Onar, you just look at where he fits. You know that Onar is good, fine. So perfect information, damage control, Onar's get down. Blind damage manipulation, he's got all of the assassinate hunter tools anyways, right? He can have his extra attack with his command card, extra protection. He can be long range slash kiting because he can use his to the limit on rush, so he can rush out, shoot, and then run back as well. He does almost every single thing. He can do VP acceleration because he has access to the hunter cards and celebration, you know, and he can do unblockable damage with rush. He's got really good efficiency in terms of health and attack dice.
Nowadays, he has access to Iron Will, so his biggest weakness was that he could be easy to kill if you focus fired him. But now,
that's right.
Now you can, if he has 4 health left or more, now you can make it so he doesn't die.
He's got so many Onar buffs now.
So what you're saying, David, is you want the ICP to create more Onars, right?
If I could play a list that was only Onars, you would be terrified.
Yes!
All right. So I think we're coming more or less to the end. Did you guys have something you wanted to spoiler?
Yes. Well, after all this very long discussion, I feel like we teased a lot here at the beginning of this 2.5-hour episode. But I feel like we teased too much if we're just going to come in with this one spoiler. But this is what we all agreed on is the most likely to make it. We're still in the tail end of the design here. But we are very proud to announce that a change that I've been advocating for since season one is finally coming into effect, and General Sorin, Vicious Tactician, and anybody who's played Return to Hoth campaign would know, the evilest bastard who just loves killing civilians more than anything else, is being reduced to 5 points.
Hey!
Oh!
So with no other changes, he's just being dropped to 5 points, which with a 0-point advanced comm system means that he will be able to do his civilian killing, focusing droids and vehicles, and giving out free attacks to anybody who will listen for 5 points.
Oh.
So this is the droid buff that we were talking about earlier.
Ooh, as an Imperial player, ooh, I can see some possibilities.
Oh yeah, because what we all needed was a focused ATST, right?
Yeah, so I've actually been playtesting around with a lot of the walkers, and I've even been running a Vice double ATST list for a while.
What?
Honestly, positioning wasn't too bad, as long as my deployment zone had 2 openings, otherwise it was a bit of a pain. It's just the damage output that hurt for me, so this, I think, could definitely make Vice pretty good. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what Sorin does.
And Vice is able to keep Sorin, is able to use his general's orders to get Sorin into range to keep up with him with the focus ability.
Exactly. So I could definitely see some awesome general alliances coming around, having the two of them work together, just a devastating effect. I think it could be awesome.
Alrighty. Well, thanks to all our listeners and for Jake and Noah for their willingness to come on to the podcast and chat about meta things.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us, or having me, I guess, since Noah's not here. I really appreciate being able to come on. I'd love to come on at some point and talk about the IACP specifically. I know this one was more about the meta tactics available, and a lot of it applies equally to FFG standard. Anyway, thanks, guys. And Jake from Twin Troopers, or formerly of Twin Troopers, it's kind of in a weird situation. Goodbye.
Everybody, I'm just back to say goodbye, and thank you so much to our hosts, David, Jess, and Isaac, for putting on such a great show. And thanks to Jake also for coming on and talking with us, talking with me and sharing his perspective. Make sure you check out IA Command on YouTube. It's my YouTube channel, and that's where we're putting up a lot of our live streamed IACP games. And I hope to keep talking to you guys on Slack and on Reddit and on the website, on the IACP website. All right. Peace out, everybody.
See you later.
Bye, everyone.